morning. I'm Ben Lima, and today I have the honor of welcoming Frederick Turner, Robert Stern, and Roger Molina, co-authors of the article A Brief History of Emergence, which will appear in the winter 2024 issue of Athenaeum Review. Thank you all very much for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
I'll mention that the links to the various resources will be linked in the show notes. So if you want to refer to the articles or videos, people will be able to find them easily. But let me start by asking, what is emergence and why is it important?
Well, I think, Ben, it'd be useful if you'd identify one of us that you'd like to answer it, because, you know, we're all very polite, as you can see. Fred was the first author, so why don't we let him go first?
Fred, what is emergence and why is it important?
Well, I was going to say Bob should give the definition, because he's very good at giving the definition. But essentially, in the physical sciences, at any rate, emergence describes the behavior of complex, interconnected systems in which the direction of, in which everything is causing everything else, and in which new states, new forms emerge, not so much driven by traditional kinds of causality, but rather drawn by attractors within the field of the of possibilities that are open to that complex system. This is sometimes also called a self-organizing system or autopoiesis. There are lots of names for it now. Nonlinear dynamical systems. These are in different fields have different names for this phenomenon, but it seems to be taking over from the classical notion of one line causality. You know, A causes B, B causes C, and so on. It now looks as if A causes B, but C sometimes causes A, and B can cause B, A and C, and so on. And so you've got something that is much more like a three-body problem than like a simple orbit of two bodies.
Okay, I'm going to jump in. Hopefully the echo is not too bad here. So I am trained as a physicist and scientist, but my view of emergence is really, what is spirituality? We're trying to figure out what's going on in the world, and when something happens, something must have caused it. So I happen to be an atheist, but some people believe in God. God created the world and humans and so on. And when you're raised as a kid, your parents teach you causality. If you do this, you'll get a good grade at school. Or if you practice your tennis a lot, you'll win. But when I became a student of physics at MIT in 1968, I got acquainted with people that were part of a group that invented the concept of cybernetics. And in a cybernetic system, there are feedback loops of different types. Yeah. If you do this, then that happens. If you're driving your car, you put your foot on the pedal and the car slows down. Well, if you didn't know about that, you'd look at the person and say, oh, did God cause your car to slow down? And so cybernetics is sort of for me, a stepping stone to emergence, as Fred explained it. We want to find patterns in the world. We want every effect to have a cause. But And so I, let me just stop there and I'll let Bob interject.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, for me, emergence is really interesting because it's not a theory and it's not a philosophy. It's both. It's neither. It's you know, you try and define it and you say, okay, what does it predict? Well, what it predicts is it can't predict. So to me, emergence, and I came about this from trying to understand Earth history, emergence is any high energy far from equilibrium system is going to take on characteristics that could not be predicted from its individual components. Yeah. So you can know all the laws of physics, but you probably wouldn't predict plate tectonics would happen on Earth. You almost certainly wouldn't predict it. Now we document plate tectonics has happened, and now we can explain it in retrospect. But the history of the Earth science is such that geophysicists for a long time said this is impossible. That's just my personal example. But I think the important thing for me is any high energy system that's far from equilibrium is going to do something unexpected. And the three of us, I think, got together because, you know, we share a long history with UT Dallas, and we see UT Dallas as a spectacular example of an emergent system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One addendum to that, I think any form, any organized system is itself a kind of predictor. It constitutes a kind of prediction, but essentially everything in the universe is in a kind of predicting contest with everything else. And what actually happens is the result of that predicting contest. Now, it's a contest not necessarily as in some forms of evolution where of survival of the fittest. Or rather, it's about what constitutes fitness. Fitness might very well be compromised, ecology, ecosystems, symbiosis, forms of being living together. I mean, I think at the very beginning of the universe, there was a kind of division between quantum physics and the classical physics of matter, and the universe sort of compromised. So we've got a little bit of both. The universe is making itself up as it goes along, and that's the idea. Now, where I think I might differ a little from Roger is that Roger feels that idea is a kind of radical opposition to theism, and I would agree that it's in radical contradiction to God deciding everything that's going to happen and making it happen. I would agree that it's not like that, but maybe the whole thing, the whole process, is itself that's what people recognized, what sages of various places across the world recognized, and that they decided to call spirits or gods or God. That we saw those systems working and found them miraculous. You know, animals, plants, all of these things that just do things by themselves. And so we named that spirit or God or whatever. And I don't think we should abandon all of that terminology.
Okay, since I've been contradicted, Bob, I'll jump in. Fred, in his opening remarks, mentioned the concept of autopoiesis.
Yes,
and that, in my terminology, sometime in a complex system that's not in equilibrium, a few things at the bottom of the system can change the whole system.
Yeah.
And since I'm an atheist, I'm going to quote Jesus Christ. He only had 12 disciples. I mean, how did he change the world with only 12 disciples? Yeah. I mean, no startup company would think that way. Well, maybe they do. But the other part of autopoiesis is our university, University of Texas at Dallas, was created by three white men in a high-tech company that had nothing to do with their money. Yeah. No, they wanted to educate their engineers, and there was no university in Texas available. So they set up their own. And it was only a graduate school for engineers and business training. But suddenly, here we are in 2023, and we have 35,000 students. We're one of the top 10 universities in Dallas. There's no way the Texas Instrument pioneers could have predicted that. And so autopoiesis, occasionally a few people, and maybe the four of us, through this podcast, could trigger something that then just sweeps through the complex system of 8 billion humans. And I'm not proposing we start a religion.
No. Malinaism.
No. Fred Bob Rogerism.
Something that I find very interesting, both in your comments now and also in the article, is that the three of you come from different disciplines and backgrounds. And I thought I would ask, let's say if you're, when you're doing your own work, your own research or your own academic pursuits, I wonder, and I'll ask anyone who is moved to answer, how this might, this understanding might kind of shape or influence the way that you approach a problem when you're doing your work.
Well, I'm happy to take a first whack at that. So in geosciences, you know, we, 150 years ago, 200 years ago, we had a battle with the religious establishment about the age of the earth and how the things that exist on the earth, including ourselves, came to be. And we, one of us pointed out very reasonably that, you know, the action of geologic processes, erosion, mountain building, earthquakes, over very, very long periods of time can completely transform the planet. And the idea what's called uniformitarianism, that basically what we see, the processes that we see today have been going on for a long, long time. You know, the Trinity River's been flowing to the sea for some amount of time, or, you know, and that is basically, that becomes a religion of its own right, that that things just always were this way. And I think that's not constructive. And in particular, my interest in the evolution of plate tectonics has sort of put me in a minority position with a lot of the geologic community that thinks that plate tectonics has been going on, you know, basically forever. And I see it as something that has evolved very, very recently. When I say recently, I mean within the last billion years. Well, maybe not so recent, according to scales. And so this in this effort to convince my colleagues that I'm right, that's what we do in this business, is to take new strategies, and uniformitarianism is the particular, I wouldn't say enemy, but because it's still useful in conversations with the religious community. But the idea that, you know, Earth has evolved into this remarkable system as a process, it just took me naturally to emergence. And, you know, the idea of emergence, it's something that it's not really belongs in the School of Natural Sciences and Mathematics. It kind of belongs more in arts and humanities. And that naturally led me to these two gentlemen, where we started a very fruitful conversation about the larger issue of emergence, not just, you know, plate tectonics emergence, but, you know, the emergence of everything. It's simply a different way of looking at our existence.
Okay. I'm going to jump in before Fred jumps in. So why did what caused the three of us to write this article? Well, when I first arrived at UT Dallas a dozen years ago, by total accident, I was on a panel about Mars, and Fred Turner had written science fiction about Mars. I'd worked for NASA and wanted to go to Mars. And so I started reading his books 12 years ago. Why do I know Bob Sturt? You know, he's a geophysicist, whatever that is. I'm an astrophysicist and an arts and humanities scholar. Well, my first student was Brian Burnham in the geology department, and he was trying to teach geologists to use computer gaming technology and all the high-tech technology that artists use for gaming and animation that scientists didn't know how to use. He's now a professor at the University of Edinburgh in England, I'm glad to say. But that led me to have connections to the geology department. I mean, normally, yeah, astrophysicists talk to geologists occasionally, you know, how long did plate tectonics last? Maybe we can tell you by looking at other planets. But, you know, a totally random set of things led me to work with Fred and Bob on this article. And so that's almost like emergence of a friendship out of nowhere. Normally, you are the company you keep. Astronomers spend most of their time talking to astronomers, not to geologists. I'm sorry, or to science fiction writers, or whatever you are this week, Fred. So let me stop there. But I think this article on emergence is a small example of emergence itself.
Yeah, well, I guess to... Well, thank you, Roger. I feel the same way about the little miracle of our collaboration here. I think I first started thinking about this very young. I realized that I was a poet even as a child, and in my schooling, I absolutely fell in love with Shakespeare, and one of the things that I noticed, especially reading the sonnets, is that Shakespeare is fascinated with the idea of time, and eventually I wrote my dissertation at Oxford, which came out as a book, Shakespeare and the Nature of Time. And so I've been interested in time forever. I'm a member of the International Society for the Study of Time. One of the things that I noticed in Shakespeare, and this was just at the time where I ran across an absolute bombshell in my life, which was getting my first understanding of the idea of evolution, of biological evolution. And I've been fascinated by biological evolution ever since. So what I noticed was that in early Shakespeare, Shakespeare's talking about time as the destroyer. Time hath transfixed the flourish set on youth and delved the parallels in beauty's brow, feeds on the rarities of nature's truth, and nothing stands but for his scythe to mow, he says in one of his sonnets. But later on in his life, in The Winter's Tale and in some of his later plays, he sees time more and more not as a destroyer, but as a creator. He sees time as, if anything, that which brings everything into being. And I'd also been studying the German philosophers and studying the European philosophy of being. And I began to realize that, Dasein and Dasein and so on in German, that I began to realize that being is not a noun, it's a verb, it's a process, that the world is making itself up as it goes along. It's not a random process. It's governed, you know, it's still constrained by what has happened before. But it's sort of still, the story is still going on. The drama is still going on. So that was how I got into it.
Something that's, this is brought up in the article, as well as you've alluded to it, but what are the implications, if one really understands emergence, what does this mean for education, for universities in particular, or for how universities or schooling institutions ought to proceed or go about their work?
Oh, wonderful.
Well, I'm happy to comment, but I think each of us, as you can see, have very different perspectives. And that's the exciting thing about this collaboration is we see things differently, but somehow similarly. Mm-hmm. So when you say should, I get nervous because emergence and should, there should, the word should implies a prediction. And the number one thing about emergence is there is no predicting. So,
you're the president of the university and you had to, you know.
Yeah. Well, so for me, my concern, I guess concerns make sense. UTD to me is the, if not the best example of an emergent university. I don't know what is. To me, my concern is with its remarkable growth, we're becoming isolated from each other. And when you have a group of high-performing, high-energy individuals and departments and schools, you want to find ways to make these groups, certain numbers, work together or at least converse. So one of the things that really stimulated this paper was we had a series of luncheons with the dean, you know, and we spent an hour talking about things and just as you can see, the three of us don't have a single story to tell. We have three different strands of the story we told, and that's continuing. And we developed those strands, I think, at those luncheons.
Okay, I'm going to jump in and contradict Fred. My colleague astrophysicists are stupid and should be poets and science fiction writers. Did time exist before the Big Bang? Well, scientists say no, there was nothing before the Big Bang. But my analogy, as you know, I just had my first grandchild, Maxine. Did time exist before his birth? Yeah. So why are astrophysicists convinced that time itself started with the Big Bang?
Well, you just asked the most famous question that St. Augustine asked. You know, what did God do before he created the universe? And he said he's thinking up hell for people who ask questions like that.
Excellent. That's funny.
But let me just also... Yeah. In any emergent system, there's something that maybe triggers it. In our case, I think it was the pandemic. So this is the first time, to our knowledge, that everybody on the planet was exposed to the same virus at the same time, roughly. And suddenly, the way that humans behave was shaken up. And I think we were an autopoetic example. Somehow we started talking online. And then we started wondering what was the university going to be like after the pandemic. And as the astronomer said, well, let's observe what's going on around us in this university that's now too big for people to collaborate with each other. It's no longer a family business. What's emerging on campus that the president of the university has no clue about? Because often the most important changes in a system, not always, come from the bottom up. And so maybe Fred and Bob can think of things that we notice that are emerging in our university. Yes, we're emergent because we're only 50 years old, And most universities, I mean, university started in 1009, I think. I forget the exact date. But what have we noticed on our campus that the president should know about?
Well, one of the things that I noticed was, one of the things I would cite is are these little groups that Raja himself has been, catalyzing, I think is the right term here, has been catalyzing among the students. And I think probably all three of us have had, at different times, we've had almost by happenstance, we've had bunches of students who started to work together, to think together, to talk, and sometimes they would have an enlightened dean who would fund their meetings to some extent. And if one could, Bob is right. One can't really. How can I put it? I think one can predict, but one can't be sure that the predictions are going to happen.
Okay. We have a recommendation for the president.
Yeah.
He should create an emergence fund of at least $10 million a year, and only the students can decide how to spend it.
Oh.
They're the ones that are going to have to live for the next 100 years, not the three of us. Who will live maybe another 20 years. So, President Benson, create an emergence fund that only students can apply for and decide how it should be spent.
Wow. I mean, I can see that there needs to be some controls over this, but...
then you have to set up an emergence observatory, which the president can, what's going on, among the 35,000 students, and so you have to set in then methodologies, and you need to understand that emergence is not predictable by, the size of the university.
I mean, maybe biology is a good analogy, that we don't just, biology doesn't come about just through variation or mutation. It needs heredity, that is, it needs genes. It needs to take into account all of its past. A species needs to take into account all of its past. And it then undergoes variation or mutation, but then it has to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. It has to deal with selection, and the selection then leads to the preservation, presumably in Darwinian terms, of characteristics that are better at surviving. So we would the fund should have it should take into account the past without being totally bound by it. It should contain the possibility for lots of mutation and variation, and particularly through cross-fertilization, as with sexual reproduction, and plenty of selection. That is, there should be a critical...
Fred, be careful. Fred, being transdisciplinary is like sexual reproduction.
Yes. Oh, yeah, very much indeed. Yeah, swapping genes, basically.
Well, if I can interject, to riff off of Roger's idea, I think $10 million would kill everything. I think what is needed is somebody needs to provide pizza and call a meeting of the Emergence Club at UT Dallas and see who shows up.
We'll send this. This will happen. We'll make this happen. We'll send it to the president. Let me just finish by asking, and I can go in order, Fred, Bob, Roger, what you're currently working on, whether it is touching on emergence as an explicit theme or not.
Oh,
okay, I've thought about it. So I have just applied to have my endowed chair extended for 6 more years. And I have decided to do it. But I don't want to keep doing the same things I did before. And one of the topics that's on my astronomer's catalog is the increase in life expectancy on our planet. Our students will likely live until the age of 100. But a lot of them are forced to retire before they're 70, or they can't walk anymore. So, oh no, you can't work, you can't walk. Well, I think we need to create the emergence of transgenerational mechanisms between the 16-year-olds and the 90-year-olds. I worked with Frank Popper. He died when he was 99. He was a peer reviewer for the Leonardo Journal that I have been the editor of. And he would type in bed. He couldn't walk. His brain was fine. And he peer reviewed articles until he was 90 years old. I mean, wow, Frank Popper. Thank you. By being an exemplar of why we need transgenerational methodologies that were unnecessary 100 years ago. So few people lived to 65 100 years ago that, well, let's not go there. Thank you.
Roger, there is a transgenerational mechanism. It's called the university.
And the internet. You have no idea online whether someone can still walk. And I think one of us in this conversation. So what's that got to do with intellectual collaboration? And so the internet caused more problems than it solved. But one of the problems it solved was allowing old people who can't walk to keep being intellectually productive.
Yeah. Hear, hear.
Yeats says, an aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a cloak, a tattered coat upon a stick. Unless soul clap its hands and sing and louder sing for every tatter in its mortal dress.
Soul wrong.
Sing for every tatter in its mortal dress. So what I'm working on at the moment is really, I'm just writing a lot of poetry, and the poetry seems to be going in all kinds of different directions. I mean,
it's called senile dementia.
I am keeping my hand in as a technician of words by translation. So I've been translating with collaborators in those languages from Albanian and Hungarian. And I'm working particularly with the great Hungarian poet Endre Ady, with Zsuzsanna Ozsvath, whom many people know of as the great scholar of the Holocaust, but she is also a tremendous literary scholar. So I'm working with her on the internet. She lives now in New York State, but we meet every week and we translate together.
So Ben, to answer your question, I'm working right now on a number of things, but one of them is trying to explain the Drake equation. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that or not, but the Drake equation basically makes a prediction about how many intelligent civilizations should be out there in the galaxy. Mm-hmm. And if you plug in the numbers into it, there should be thousands, if not hundreds of thousands. Now, this was called into question by Fermi, who said, okay, I see your numbers, but why haven't we heard from any of them? It's called the Fermi paradox. So the question has been, obviously, either they've all in cahoots to not identify themselves to us, which seems unlikely. They don't really know about us that well, I don't think. Or there's something in the Drake equation that is not accurately
estimated.
Let me finish. And so we're working on
the conspiracy theorists. Should we give the aliens are already here? We should give them the vote.
So just to finish up, the idea is that plate tectonics and the presence of oceans and continents is critical, because life has to start and evolve to a certain extent in the ocean. But then, and to become a technological civilization, it has to come up on dry land. So you have to have those two things. But the things that plate tectonics does is it creates opportunities for diversification that don't exist on planets that don't have plate tectonics. And we haven't really, it's very difficult to quantify that effect, but it seems to be huge. So it may be that the Drake equation needs a new term for the, for two new terms, actually. One for the presence of plate tectonics operating for at least 500 million years, and the other being the presence of continents and oceans. And this is, you know, we've written a manuscript, submitted it, got scathing reviews, revised it. We just got back our scathing reviews again, so we'll keep revising it. So we know we're onto something good, because the critics, referees hate it.
Bob, I'd love to help you on the scathing. I'm a member of a group called METI, Messaging to Extraterrestrials. And the fundamental question is carbon-based life the only possible form of life in the universe? And the narrative you just gave me about plate tectonics and evolution and water, well, that applies to our kind of life, but maybe there are billions of other kinds of life, silicon-based life, like AI. I mean, maybe AI will leave the planet soon. We think life needs water and plate tectonics, but maybe there are other forms of life.
Well, there's, I don't know whether there's another element besides carbon that is so versatile. One possible outcome of this thought, that is, this planet is pretty much unique, might be that we're the first. That if any other species had, intelligent species had evolved, it would only take a couple of million years for them to be everywhere else, including here. And they're not here yet, which means, I mean, maybe we're the first. Maybe it's on us. Maybe the whole thing is on us. That's just a maybe. I mean, I would love for there to be all kinds of other species out there with their own histories and art.
We should seed the universe with humankind.
Yeah,
but I think that's called the apostles.
Well, let's be realistic. People can't make those trips. We can't even make it to Mars. We're going to be sending robots who can make new robots and go anywhere they want. That is the way that we will announce our presence to the universe.
Well, we pack all the information of a fully equipped spacecraft into a proton and send it off at the speed of light, and have it reconstitute itself when it comes across an atmosphere.
Okay, NASA, give Fred Turner $1 billion.
Yeah. we'll stop there, but I've been speaking today with Frederick Turner, Robert Stern, and Roger Molina, co-authors of A Brief History of Emergence in Athenaeum Review. Thank you all for having this conversation.
Thank you.
And you can find out more at athenaeumreview.org.